Hey friends, this episode of Seminary Dropout is sponsored by the new book, Fish Sandwiches, The Delight of Receiving God's Promises by author Troy Schmidt. The book shows us how Jesus provides for us just like he did in the feeding of the 5,000, not only for our physical health, but our spiritual health as well. Is the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000 just a story about something that happened in the past, or does it have something to tell us today about how Jesus wants to provide in our own lives when we experience lack? This warm and down-to-earth book invites you to sit in on one of the most miraculous moments of human history, when one man took a few fish and a couple of loaves of bread and fed an entire village. Check out the book that Max Lucado says is a joy to the heart and strength to the soul. You can get Fish Sandwiches wherever books are sold. You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest, Michael Rhodes, is Director of Community Transformation at the Memphis Center for Urban Theological Studies, where he heads up efforts to equip pastors and community development practitioners with theologically informed tools for community transformation. His new book is called Practicing the King's Economy, Honoring Jesus in How We Work, Earn, Spend, Save, and Give. It's written with his co-author, Robbie Holt. Michael, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Thanks so much, Shane. Really happy to be with you here.
Your day job is teaching at the Memphis Center of Urban and Theological Studies. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what that entails.
Yeah, so the Memphis Center for Urban and Theological Studies, or MCUTS, is a really remarkable institution. We're a Bible college that was formed about 15 years ago with a mission to offer affordable, accessible, accredited undergraduate theological education to pastors in our city who hadn't had the opportunity to get that kind of education or training. And so our early on, in particular, our primary student was a bivocational minister. We work exclusively with adults, and all of our classes are at night. Almost all of our students are working. And it's just a really exciting place to be because my students have a lot to teach me. I have a lot to learn from them, and they're engaged in frontline ministry across our city, oftentimes in very poor communities, which is a passion of mine. And so it's a really exciting place to be. And I started here at MCUTS a few years ago after spending 7 or 8 years working in community development for nonprofits. I came here to help equip our students to lead community development initiatives in their churches or in nonprofits in the community. So we really believe in a church-based movement of community transformation where churches and Christians are embodying the good news that is good news for the poor and marginalized in practical ways. And so it's just an enormous privilege to get to work with our students on those issues and train students to think theologically about mission and their context, but also to equip our students with practical tools for community development to see what they do with them in their own context. So really can't say enough good things about MCUTS and the opportunity that I have to work here.
I mean, one of the common complaints I hear about theological education is that it often leaves people really unprepared for real life ministry.
Yeah, that's right.
It seems like MCUTS really has their sights set on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. You know, from my own experience, when I was in seminary, I knew that I was supposed to be working for this nonprofit in Memphis called Advance Memphis that does economic development with adults in one community in our city, and I knew I was supposed to be in seminary, and those are the two things I knew, and so there wasn't. Those options didn't seem to make a lot of sense, but the upshot was I did my master's in Bible part-time, commuting several times a year, and as a result, I never left the community that I was serving. When I was in seminary working on papers and studying, I was always thinking about how that stuff worked out in our context of trying to love our low-income neighbors as an expression of the gospel. So for me, that was really an awesome way to do theological education, and kept me from burnout, I think. And I think our students are having similar experiences because they come with questions. They come with a desire to help their neighbors or to tell other people about Jesus or whatever. And we are giving them education that they have a felt need for in that journey. So, you know, one of my early experiences here, I had a really incredible student who's, you know, in grad school now and serving at a church in a community development capacity. But in one of my classes, he said, you know, I think I'm in ministry, I'm pastoring, I'm working a day job. I think my passion has always been community development and this kind of ministry, and I just didn't have the words for it and didn't know what it was. And so it was just an incredible opportunity for us to like be offering theological education that really matters for people doing the work. And it's really rewarding, you know?
Well, I'll make sure to put a link to MCUTS on the show, yeah. The show notes for the show. So if people are interested in that, please go check it out. I mentioned the title of the book is Practicing the King's Economy, Honoring Jesus and How We Work, Earn, Spend, Save, and Give. You wrote this with a co-author, Robbie Holt, and then Brian Ficker kind of helped shape it a little bit and help with the editing. Well, maybe a lot of people out there might know Brian from his book, When Helping Hurts. And he was on the show a couple of years ago whenever the 10th anniversary book came out for When Helping Hurts. So I wonder if you want to tell me the story behind the book.
Yeah. So, I mean, two ways to tell the story. One is that I was Brian's student at Covenant College when I was there as an undergraduate student studying community development. And I was Robbie was my pastor during that time. So it was part of the story is the story of our friendship over, you know, 12 or 13 years talking about what the gospel means for the kingdom of God and for our lives seeking that kingdom. And when I got out of Covenant, I worked for 2 years in Kenya as an agricultural development missionary. And then I came back to this organization I've already mentioned, Advance. And Advance serves this one neighborhood in our city, one South Memphis neighborhood. That's the neighborhood with some of the hardest economic problems, one of the lower income neighborhoods in our community. And when my wife and I got back from Kenya, we moved into that community and started working there. And I got involved with job training and financial literacy and GED tutoring and entrepreneurship support, you know, supporting aspiring entrepreneurs, our neighbors. Just really fell in love with our neighborhood and the people who are my neighbors now and have been for 8 years or so. And a lot of that kind of ministry came out of the sort of When Helping Hurts model and the Chalmers Center's work to promote financial literacy initiatives like faith and finances or job training initiatives like work life. But I was also, because I personally come from a more middle upper income family and community, you know, I was getting asked to come talk about our work in churches and share what we were doing. And I started to realize that, you know, at Advance, working with, you know, people with criminal records who are looking for a job or someone who wants to start a small business, you know, no matter how sophisticated our programming, no matter how much money people donated, we didn't have a model for the work that we were doing. If we didn't have business owners somewhere who would say, yeah, I'm willing to hire somebody even though they have a violent criminal record. If we didn't have somebody who's willing to do that, we could do all the job training in the world. We didn't have a model. If we didn't have somebody who said, yeah, I'm willing to mentor and then possibly hire one of your aspiring entrepreneurs to cater a work lunch or, you know, DJ a party, you know, we just didn't have a model. In other words, if people weren't living differently in the way that they spent money, earned money, compensated, hired, invested, we were not going to be able to embody the good news of God's kingdom in our neighborhood the way that we felt like God was calling us to. And then, you know, we kind of, as we're having that conversation, started realizing that the church wasn't discipling people, or the churches that we were connected to too often weren't discipling people to live kingdom economic lives anywhere except for in what they gave. So economic discipleship in the church has so often been make as much as you can, save as much as you can, give as much as you can. But we were seeing a need for people to actually live differently in the way they engage their marketplace life outside of just giving. So that's kind of how we started working on the book. And as we did that, you know, we sort of came up with these six themes from Scripture that we think should shape our economic lives. And they include radical generosity, but they also include thinking about how we create opportunities for job seekers, how we invest in minority-owned businesses, how we care for the created world and the way we engage our economic lives, and much more. So that's kind of the story behind the book, at least from my own personal story.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you start in the book by focusing on worship. And that just seemed like a really purposeful decision on your part.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, it's really funny. We wrote the book, and the first two themes that we treat are you know, we suggest that our economic lives should be shaped by worship and by community. And we realized, I realized after we'd written this whole thing, that we started with love of God and love of neighbor, which, you know, somebody famous said that already. We could have known out of the gate that that's what we should be talking about. But I really do think, you know, I feel like one of the major themes of the book is that we're trying to help present God's people with tools for economic discipleship in his kingdom. And the challenge is that we've already had economic discipleship in the world's kingdom, in an American kingdom, the kingdoms of the communities and the economies in which we live. And what that means all too often is that when we think about economic discipleship, we're already caught up in idolatry out of the gate. And so we start with worship because we believe that worship is an economic issue. God demands and invites us to worship him with all of our lives, including how we arrange our economic lives, but that also our idolatry is often economic. And, we draw attention to, like, you know, this when we get to First Kings or something and we're reading about the Israelites worshiping Baal. You know, for a long time when I read that story, I thought that, like, you know, somebody had knocked on the Israelites' door and you know, they had a Baal tract and they walked them through, like, the four spiritual laws of Baal and convinced them that Baal was a better god, or like that they just saw Baal statues and thought they were super pretty and so they worshiped him or something. But in reality, in the ancient world, among Israel's neighbors, Baal was the god who was known as the rider on the storm clouds. And when he shows up, the cows get fat, the river runs with oil, and you get the rain that you need for your business, which is your farm, to prosper. And so if you're this poor peasant, it's really tempting to worship Baal instead of the Lord or alongside the Lord in order to try to secure your economic life. And I think that's the kind of background that we should have when we hear Jesus saying, you cannot worship God and mammon. You cannot worship God and money. And so if there is one threat to God's people living faithfully in his kingdom economy, that threat is that we are already caught up in economic idolatry out of the gate. And so we have to start embracing and practicing God's economy has to start with unwinding that idolatry, that economic idolatry, by worshiping God, not least with our economic lives.
I mean, I think that there's a sense among Christians that all aspects of our life should be a little bit different than the world at large. Yes. But there is so little practical direction concerning finances for, yes, for Christians out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great point. You know, in our introduction, we use this analogy where we say, you know, it's kind of like we're NFL linemen, you know, and like an NFL lineman can bench press like, you know, 1,000,000 pounds, and he's enormous, and he can, you know, run super fast for short distances. And an NFL lineman is one of the top athletes on the planet. But if his coach walks in one day and says, "Hey, from now on, we're running triathletes," you know, all of his training is actually going to make running the triathlon harder right? Like the bulk and the weight training, the exercise regime, the formation that that lineman has engaged in to be good at being an NFL lineman is going to be a liability oftentimes in him becoming a triathlete. And we think in the West, we are so shaped and trained and formed by way of economic life that is relentlessly individualistic, that sees people as experiencing happiness through consuming more goods and services, that's based on a deep sense of scarcity, that there's not enough, that we have limitless desires in a limited world. And we've become really good, even as Christians, at playing and winning that sport. But that means that when Jesus shows up talking about, like, you know, consider the ravens, you know, look at the lilies, you know, give without expecting return, forgive debts, we it blindsides us, and it's almost debilitating because it's so different from the sport that we've been playing. And so if we're going to get practical, we're going to have to first encounter how countercultural God's kingdom really is. And that's why we spend so much time in this book looking at God's word and saying, what's God's heart for economic lives? But then we're going to have to, like, really get out there and begin a new exercise regime, a new pattern of training, a new set of drills to help us become the sorts of people capable of living faithfully in God's economy. And that's why we spend a lot of time in the book giving, you know, really practical sort of baby steps for beginning to practice the Jesus economy in our own lives.
I'm curious to know your thoughts just on capitalism in general, and if capitalism is something that God can work through, work in spite of, or how that fits into just to God's kingdom.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's surprisingly, in some ways, is a question we just don't address in the book. In fact, we kind of make a commitment that we name up front that none of the things we talk about in the book are public policy issues, which is what a book like Practicing the King's Economy might lead you to expect. And there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, one is that, and we use this example in the book, you know, right now, some of your listeners are smart people who love Jesus, who care about the poor, being able to provide for themselves through work. And they are utterly convinced that the rising tide of the free market lifts all boats. And so if we love the poor and care about them being able to provide for themselves, we should advocate for, like, pretty rigorous free market capitalist policy.
Right.
And some of your readers are like, yeah, that's obvious. But then other people, you know, who love Jesus and are smart and really care about God's heart for the poor would say, you know, the rising tide can't really help you if you don't have a boat. In fact, it might even drown you. Mm. So we think that the government needs to get more involved in how markets function for the good of everybody. And the truth is, there's a lot of debate, and we don't actually know the answers to all of those questions, which are extremely important, and God wants his people to address them. You know, God wants us to contribute to answering these questions. But our fear is that so often we jump straight there to the, you know, what system, what public policy proposal, that we miss that economic justice in the Bible begins in our fields. It begins in the way that we treat those who we supervise or who work for us, those who need support from us. And if you think about the gleaning laws in the Old Testament, economic justice means that business owners leave profits unharvested in their fields to create work for those who are the most marginalized in society, for immigrants, for widows, for orphans. And so economic justice begins in our own fields. And we think that there's a ton of work that God's people can do across the ideological spectrum on issues of capitalism and socialism and whatever else. And we can do it together as a faithful expression of God's word and of our heart for his kingdom. And we actually think that because we're like linemen who've been called to be triathletes, one of the reasons why we don't get very far when we have those systems level conversations is because we haven't become people capable of contributing to those system level conversations. So amidst all the talk of common good stuff, you know, how do we promote systems that are for the common good? We want to say, yes, that's an important question. It's a vital question. But what we're really addressing in this book is, how do we become the uncommonly good people of Jesus by following him in creating economic opportunity in our own economic lives, our own businesses, our own marketplace transactions, so that we have something to contribute to those common good questions? And so it's a long answer to a short question, but the cash value for me is just to say, we think the free market capitalist system that we currently have, which is not a pure free market capitalist model, it's what we have, but we think it has tremendous problems, and it presents the church with tremendous opportunities. And we're much more interested in talking about how God's people can use the system that we've got to pursue God's kingdom than we are about trying to dial into the details of how that system functions, not least because we think people who use the system we've got to overcome economic injustice will have more to contribute to those policy questions down the road.
You mentioned the Old Testament gleaning laws. So
yeah,
the book, the format of the book is essentially, we're going to show you in scripture this kind of principle, I guess you could call them like an economic principle, that really is just reflective of the nature of God and God's relation to human beings.
Yes.
And then the preceding chapter, you outline how we can reflect that today, how we can live that out today. So one of the things that you talk about a lot is the Old Testament gleaning laws. So I just had Carolyn Custis James on the show to talk about her book on Ruth that she just published, which has a lot to do, that story and the book have a lot to do with the Old Testament gleaning laws. For those who don't know, can you just explain what they were and how they worked?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love that you had James on recently. Her work is so good.
Yes.
So the gleaning laws basically say, when you go to harvest your field, and remember, we're in an agricultural economy, so the field is the family business. So when the family goes to bring in the profits, the harvest, from their family business, they have to leave the edges of the field unharvested, and so that immigrants, orphans, widows, and the poor can come and gather those leftover profits on the edges of those fields. And what's really remarkable about this is that one of the big themes that we talk about in the book is that God's people aren't called to have a soup kitchen where we feed people. Primarily, we're called to embody a potluck where everybody is welcome and can bring a plate. And so what the gleaning laws do is that they allow the most vulnerable members of society to provide for themselves and their families and to contribute to the community through their own work. And it does that by requiring the business owner to bend the way they work, to bend their workplace towards inclusion, towards welcoming the other. And the net result is that the business owner and the refugee from the neighboring country are in the same field together. And all of those dynamics are at play in the book of Ruth. So if you think about Ruth, at the beginning of the book, Ruth is wrong on every count. She's the wrong ethnicity as a Moabitess, which is she was one of the enemies of God's people. She's the wrong religion. They have the wrong gods. She's the wrong gender. She's a woman in a man's world. She's the wrong status. She's a childless widow. She is the lowest. She's not even on the rung of the ladder of social hierarchy in Israel at the beginning of the book. And by the end of the book of Ruth, Boaz says she's inspired the entire neighborhood. the Israelite women say that this Moabite woman is worth more to her mother-in-law than seven Israelite sons in an incredibly patriarchal culture. And Ruth herself has become the great-great-great-great-grandmother of David and by extension made it into the family tree of Jesus. So the Book of Ruth is the story of a total outsider becoming fully included and invested in the neighborhood. And none of that happens if Ruth doesn't bring her abilities and willingness to work and desire to love and serve her family and community. And if Boaz doesn't obey the gleaning laws, leave profits in his field, and bend his economic life towards including those who are currently excluded. And so, I mean, what a powerful paradigm for how we can, in our lives today, explore ways to welcome those who are excluded from our economic lives to experience inclusion in those economic lives.
One of the things that strikes me about the gleaning laws is today we have a real bifurcation so that a business is – their job is to make as much money as they can. And and then in a different part of town, we have maybe a food pantry, a soup kitchen, or a homeless shelter. And their job is to, you know, do what they can to take care of those in poverty with what they can. And maybe even that business contributes some profits to help out that place. But it's all very designed to, for one set of people to never have to rub shoulders with those in poverty and never have much contact with them. And there's a little more skin in the game with the gleaning laws.
That's such a great point, Jane. And I think, you know, we talked about worship and then we talked about the gleaning laws, which we discuss under the theme of work. But for us, the middle theme there is community. And that's where we talk about that vision of the potluck and this idea that our economic lives should be aimed at love of God through worship, but also through love of our neighbor by participating in creating communities where people can gather and belong to each other across ethnic and economic lines. And you know, you see this in the Old Testament where, as one Christian economist puts it, the horizon of Israel's economy is the feast. So the way that you know that the economy has worked, that your labor has paid off, is that several times a year you have enough abundance to all travel, every single person, rich, poor, alien and foreigner, immigrant and native born. You all get together, men and women, servants, Levites, everybody, and you go to the central worship sanctuary and you have these huge feasts on the abundance that God has provided economically. And so the goal of the economic of your economic life isn't like my individual welfare, it's the community's celebration. And so from that perspective, it's incredibly ironic that we don't see who's in our community or what we pay workers for that matter often as an economic justice issue. But then in November, we tell everybody that we need to give money to buy turkeys, oftentimes for people who are working and are paid such low wages they can't afford their own turkeys. And we offer those turkeys to be eaten over there somewhere else far away from us. And so I think all of that is part of this broken Christian imagination that we have where we really have kind of adopted the world's way of doing things economically. Earn as much as you can. And then, oh, by the way, because you earn so much, you'll have some leftovers to give away versus a biblical perspective where we're saying, how is the whole of our economic lives aimed at love of God, love of neighbor? How is the whole of our economic lives aimed at bringing a plate to this potluck that God is throwing, which everyone gives to everyone else and everyone receives from everyone else?
Well, I think you hit on something that the book does a really good job of, which is it's Sure. It is about helping those in poverty, helping those that have been kind of forgotten and left behind. But all of that is really couched in this bigger conversation about God's vision for community in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think, you know, Brian, who, as you mentioned in the intro, played kind of an editorial role and was at the table while we designed the outline of the book and stuff, and really influence, you know, has been a huge influence for Robbie and me both. You know, he's an economist. He's a Yale-trained economist. And he likes to point out that, you know, since the Second Great War, we've seen per capita incomes triple. Right, so we're three times richer per person than we used to be in this country, and we were already, you know, the richest nation on earth. And yet, over that same period, Americans have reported themselves to be no less happy, even a little bit less happy, over that 30-year period. So our economic life has proved to be the way we do economy is really good at increasing individual economic growth, or at least for some, it is really good at that. But what it's lousy at is helping us experience life together. And in fact, as self-reported happiness has stayed the same or even gone down, suicide and mental illness have spiked up dramatically. And as a people, as Christians, we actually give a lower percentage of those tripled incomes than we did 40 or 50 years ago. Mm. And so, you know, the numbers paint a picture of a way of life that doesn't work even for those it's working for, right? So even the people on top, this way of life doesn't work for. And that's not surprising, because Paul told us that the love of money is a root of all evil. And it can lead people into a temptation and a trap, and for us to pierce ourselves with many griefs, and even lead people away from the faith. And so we think that what we're seeing is a way of life dominated by that kind of idolatry. And so the good news that we're talking about in this book, we all three of us are particularly committed to it being good news for the poor and economically marginalized. But the truth is, it's good news for all of us. It's good news for all of us, because God is welcoming us to a feast that is far better than the one that we've tried to set for ourselves with our own selfish ways of being in the world.
You have so many stories in the book of yeah. people who are actually like doing the things you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's just so refreshing to hear all of these things about business owners who are, you know, providing training and providing, they've got, you know, daycares because they want to help single mothers. They're hiring people with criminal backgrounds that couldn't get hired anywhere else. Can you tell us just about one or two of those people and the stories and companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell a few stories. One is of my friend Donald, who is a historic South Memphis neighbor of mine, who grew up in the community where I live. And, you know, Donald had a really, really rough growing up years. He's a career violent felon, multiple violent felonies. He used to be on crack. He lived on the street. And one day a pastor, a heroic pastor, our neighborhood pastor, Lamar Walker, told him about Jesus, and Donald came to faith, and he became a new creation in Christ, and it transformed his life. But he still needed a job, and so he came to Advance Memphis, and that's where I worked. And he went through our job training program, and through partnerships with businesses that we found, primarily by appealing to Christians in those businesses, he was able to get a job. And then he was able to get a promotion. He was able to get a better job. And then we found out about this phenomenal organization in Chattanooga called Launch Chattanooga that was working to help people, particularly from difficult backgrounds, start businesses. And guys like Donald were telling us, hey, I've always wanted to start a business. So we worked with Hal Bowling and his team at Launch Chattanooga to bring that model to Advance. And so Donald went through this 10-week entrepreneurship class to learn how to start his lawn care business that he'd always wanted to start. And at the time, Donald was pretty shy, and you know, so we get to pitch night and he's presenting his business. And at the time he wasn't a great public speaker. And so, you know, his pitch was nothing to marvel about, but sort of towards the end of it, his wife, Jean, who'd gone through the class with him, said, "Donald, tell him about the jobs." And it was like Donald transformed into this like charismatic Baptist preacher. And he was like, I want to start this business so I can give men in my neighborhood who are going to turn to drugs and crime because they don't think they can have a shot at a job. I want to give them a chance. You know, and in the years since then, Donald has launched this side business, which supplements his income in a really significant way. He's able to give friends and family members who don't have an opportunity to work otherwise an opportunity to work in his business. And it's empowered Donald to give a good plate to our community, not just by having more money for his family and to give to the church, but also in our neighborhood where 7 out of 10 adults are not working. 7 out of 10 adults. We now have a guy like Donald that we see out there working, earning a living, creating opportunity for others and serving our neighbors. And so I love Donald's story as an example of someone from a community like my adopted community who's really practicing the King's economy in his own life. Another story would be my friend Wes Gardner, who's a serial entrepreneur out in Denver, Colorado, a very successful, very generous guy. But he read this study that said, hey, what everyone in the world wants is a good job. And he said, okay, I'm a business owner. That's kind of what I do. So how can I bend my business towards helping people find jobs? And so he started partnering with a couple nonprofits. One was a halfway house for teen moms. And another was a residential facility for people coming out of substance abuse. And he started hiring these folks for 12 to 18 months as part of their career partnership program. And at the end of that time, they either go and can find their own job or he hires them on permanently himself. And it's just amazing to hear the stories of what a difference work has made for some of the folks who've been through that program, but also for Wes and his business. And he told me one time, you know, now, Michael, when I look at my balance statement and I see all that our business spends on people, which is seen as a cost in his budget and in his business budget, you know, all this money they spend on people, is I look at that number and I say, look how much money we have made together. And so his way of doing business has been reshaped by kind of this potluck idea that what we're doing at work is together welcoming one another to bring our best gifts to the party, to the community. And the exciting thing is that people are finding ways to partner in this work at every level. I mean, we tell a lot of stories about business owners, but we also tell stories about churches, you know, churches that find ways to hire minority-owned businesses or people who are coming to the church who are experiencing homelessness, hiring them to help set up the chairs or to serve in the clothes closet. We tell stories about families who are figuring out ways to hire people at their homes and their businesses, how to invest even very small amounts of money into some of these micro businesses. And so we believe this is a really exciting set of opportunities for God's people, but it's also really doable. The stories and practices that we tell are accessible to everyday folks like you and me.
So I wonder what you would say for the person listening who's wondering how they can just get started, like what might be a first step for them. And I wonder what that would be for, I'm thinking of three different people, maybe a business owner, and then someone who is a leader in a church. So maybe a pastor, but maybe just somebody in the pew as well. And then the third person, just someone who's not in charge at their place of work. They just have the job that they go to. They're a coder, they're in insurance or something like that. For all three of those people in those positions, I wonder what advice you might have about how they can get started.
Yeah, I mean, Shane, that's such a great question. And it's a really big question. And I just want to reiterate that in the book, you know, we talk about six themes, worship, community, work, equity, creation, care, and rest. And for each of those themes, we provide a list of possible starting places or practices, and we divide them up based on people in their families, people at church, and people at work. So the whole book serves as kind of a choose your own adventure, how to get started deal. So, you know, I I just want to name that our book is filled with ideas like this. But for the person in their business, if you're a business owner or if you have influence in your workplace, I mean, I think you need to begin by asking yourself, do we have the ability to welcome people who are having a hard time finding work into our business? And many, many businesses hire entry-level employees or employees who they could work with. There are nonprofits and churches in your city, in your town, in your neighborhood that work with people looking for jobs. How could you partner with them to bring those folks into your workplace? And even once they're there, that will begin helping you see what sorts of policies and practices make your workplace a welcoming place for those who are struggling, and to see that work as part of your Christian calling. So for a business owner, I think you start by asking, who do we have the opportunity to intentionally hire, to bend our hiring towards the marginalized, either in the way we structure our workplace or in how we partner with nonprofits or churches that are in touch with job seekers. If you're a church or a family, you have those exact same opportunities. You know, depending on the size of your church, if you're a large church, you're already spending all kinds of money on people, right? And even if you're a small church, one of my heroes, who I talk a lot in two chapters in the book, is Pastor Marlon Foster. He's an African-American pastor. He lives about half a mile south of me. He lives and works and worships, leads a nonprofit, and planted a church all on the street that he grew up on. And he's one of the most incredible ministers, leaders that I know. But last time I was at his church building, you know, we were out front and he said, "Man, every dollar we can spend, we spend in the community." And he starts pointing and he goes, "That person over there, she is the person who has the cleaning contract for the church. That guy over there is the person who, with his catering business, he cooks all of our meals when we have meal functions. That person over there cuts the grass." And so churches, particularly larger churches, but even small churches, can say, how can we support minority-owned businesses? How can we support aspiring entrepreneurs? How can we support job seekers in the way we hire folks and in who we contract with to do work for us? You can also, in your church, ask, who are the job seekers in this community, in this congregation, and in this community? Who are the gatekeepers to jobs in this congregation, this community? So one thing our church is doing this summer is we're trying to match youth who need summer jobs, many of them from struggling schools and neighborhoods, with gatekeepers to jobs in the community. And we're hopeful that we're going to have six or eight, you know, youth working this summer at employers represented by our congregants and their friends. And so, you know, we're really excited about that. And if you're an individual, you can participate in some of those same ways too. You can also look into investing in minority-owned or businesses started by low-income folks, even for as low as $25 for something through something like Kiva.org. If you don't know about Kiva.org, check out Kiva.org. But there are also other ways to get involved. For instance, in the Worship Key, we talk about the practice of sacrificial giving. So one practice that some friends of ours do is, you know, once a week, they eat rice and beans instead of a regular full meal as a family. They talk about world hunger and they give what they save to an organization dealing with hunger in our city or world. So how could anybody find ways to give up something in order to be able to give more? Or if it's the community key, how do we begin creating meals and feasts together that bring people together across all sorts of lines that divide us? Could people among your listeners who maybe don't have influence at work, could they find ways to volunteer with an organization that's working on economic development or working on empowerment and or working on welcoming refugees and immigrants, getting to know those people and beginning to just share meals together and figure out what would it take for my new friend to be a fully vested member of this society and economy, and how might the people in my network bend our economic lives towards that task? So there's a million ways to get involved, and we really think everybody's going to be able to find something that strikes a nerve with them, but that also is accessible to them to get started right away.
Several years ago, someone in my family made a a loan to through Kiva in my name for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I have ever since then, I've been reinvesting that same money in Kiva. It's so cool. And honestly, I haven't put more money in it. It's that same, I think it was like $75, something like that.
And
every once in a while I get an email that says your loan has been paid back. You have this much, you know, in your account, and I'll go back in. And it's so cool how it connects people, because I can search for people by country. I can search by the trade that they do. I could search for if I want to help specifically like a single parent or something like that. Just a very cool tool that it's been really fun to participate in.
Absolutely. And you know, Kiva on the US side, you know, is pretty easy to apply for a Kiva loan. So if you're in a church and you got people who want to start small businesses or have small businesses that could use a $5,000 to $10,000 zero interest loan, you could help them connect with Kiva and then advertise their loan fundraising campaign in your congregation or in your Sunday school or whatever. So there's just so many ways to get involved that are not only good for our neighbors, but they're good for us, because they begin to reshape our hearts to see and experience our generous King and his generous kingdom.
As we're wrapping it up here, I wanted to just talk briefly about just the plight of people who have criminal records in this country and how difficult it is for some of them, for most of them to get jobs, and how so many companies will, you know, there's just a box on their application that you have to check if you have a criminal background. And that is, for so many of them, that's an automatic, you know, the companies will automatically count those people out. And I think we just don't realize what, having a criminal background, even for nonviolent offenses and some minor offenses, how that can so often be a life sentence of poverty for those people.
Yes, absolutely. You know, in my work at Advance, you know, our job training program, we had probably 100 plus graduates every year from our neighborhood, and not all of those had criminal records by a long shot, but a significant percentage did. And so, you know, for 5 years of my life, you know, I probably worked with 400 or 500 different job seekers in our community, probably some significant percentage of which were facing that issue. And I think most Christians just have never had an encounter that forced them to think about what it would be like to have a criminal record from something you did in the past that was going to haunt you forever. So 6 out of 10 employers in one multi-city study said they would definitely not or probably not hire someone with a criminal record. 6 out of 10. So your listeners have all had a job search like I have. They know how stressful that is. Imagine if 6 out of 10 doors were closed out of the gate. And then if you have a low educational attainment in your background as well, I mean, it's just extremely difficult. And this is an issue that's going to face you the rest of your life. And I think as Christians, the reason why we're not doing more about this is, one, we often in our middle class context, we don't know people facing this issue. And so that's where, you know, back to the community key, we've got to begin embodying the beloved community together as an act of Christian discipleship. We've got to figure out how to make friends and become family across those lines. So they're the people. At least, you know, the people in our community who love Jesus who are facing this problem are people that we know and connect to and are bearing burdens with one another. But then secondly, we've got to have preaching and teaching that tells people who have influence over those systems that they need to think about welcoming people with criminal records as an act of Christian discipleship. So, of course, there are professions where we need to have high bars to entry. But we're seeing people screened out for nonviolent offenses in industries where this is totally irrelevant. In fact, one thing that your listeners may not know happens is in Memphis, like a lot of people get on through temporary services. So they're hired at a business through a temporary service who's technically their employer for maybe 90 days or 6 months or even longer. And I have friends who go through a temporary service, they get a job, their supervisor on that job likes them, trusts them, wants to promote them, is saying, we want to bring this person on. And at that point, they do the background check and then they fire that person because they have a misdemeanor, right? So we've got to have Christians addressing those issues where we have influence, because those are acts of Christian discipleship. And it's just, it's a huge need. And it's one that, that we hope these ideas in this book make some small contribution to helping God's people address it.
Well, Michael, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on Seminary Dropout. It's been a good time talking with you.
Yeah, Shane, thanks so much. It's been really fun. Thanks for your interest in your work. And yeah, just happy to be here.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have, and I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code SeminaryDropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press become a patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah,